I felt like I did all the right things to prepare for this game.
We put the Crosby score.
Give them 20 minutes of room where they can make a bleed for it, and we did.
He doesn't sign with Winnipeg Jets in the next couple of weeks. No player will be more coveted.
Dustin Byfuglien posts it in. It's a rocket of a shot.
This is NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Skinny's back in behind his own net, plays around the boards. It came awkwardly there and picked up and a shot by Shankly. Score! Off the post and in! That's a huge goal for Mark Shankly and the Winnipeg Jets, and they lead it 3-1.
It proved to be the game-winning goal as the Winnipeg Jets defeated the Philadelphia Flyers last night by a 3-2 margin. Flyers scoring a meaningless goal with 2 seconds to play. Jets win their third in a row. Far too little, far too late, unfortunately, for the hometown team, as they are just padding the stats now as we approach the final 10 or so games of the regular season. Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this evening at tsn1290.ca, we welcome you to NHL This Week. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg, Sean Assor with you in studio. I must say, before we get into the game, Sean, you look puzzled. You're looking for something behind your computer monitor, and you have a very puzzled look on your face.
I was trying to help out my friend here, Ezra Ginsberg, trying to find the cables.
Yeah, we're having a few internet problems. It's okay. We're good still.
There's the red cable, the red Ethernet cable that symbolized as he uses to plug in to get online, and the red Ethernet cable seems to have vanished. Somebody has walked off with the Ethernet cable.
You know, Drew, I could do the entire show without the internet.
Well, you know, you are a human computer is what I like to refer to you as.
Yeah. I'm a human computer from 1992.
Yeah, like a real old
really
desktop
slow, like
computer.
486.
Yeah, with a dot matrix printer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much what you are. But, you know, we appreciate you as a human computer nonetheless.
You know, getting right into that game, Drew, if we can.
Are we going to start with the game, or are we going to start with some of the post-game calls from last night?
No, well, there were some good ones.
Yeah.
When you talk about last night's game.
Yeah.
First off, that was probably the most boring first period I've ever seen in my entire life. I'm talking about all levels of hockey.
Yeah.
How do you not have any combined shots in 6.5 minutes in the NHL? I don't remember the last time I ever saw that at any level of hockey.
I'll tell you how you have
it. It was an embarrassing performance from the Philadelphia Flyers.
Well, and today the Flyers, I don't know if you saw the, I think it was the tweet came out from Sam Carcitti, who's covered the Flyers either Sam Carcitti or Tim Panaccio, one of the guys who've been long-term Flyers beat writers. The Flyers players were very upset that the writers last night, some of the writers said that they played with no heart in the course of the game.
You know what they should be upset about?
Their performance?
That they're not going to the playoffs this year.
That would be something to be upset about.
And, you know, Drew, last week the Philadelphia Flyers lost 6-2 to the New Jersey Devils, and entering that game, the Devils had lost 10 in a row.
Right. They hadn't won in something like a month or something along those lines.
And now the Devils have won 2 in a row, so maybe they're going to make a run here and go to the playoffs. I'm kidding, of course.
Okay, good.
But when you're talking about that,
sometimes they can never tell with you dot matrix printers.
I mean, entering that game, Drew, the Flyers were 7 points behind the Leafs for that last playoff spot.
Yeah.
And you would think that the Flyers would come out of the gate just absolutely flying all over the Jets. 0 shots in 6.5 minutes. Now, the Jets didn't have any shots either. But the Flyers are playing for their lives here. And when you talk about Claude Giroux and...
So you're saying the Flyers, the Jets are 10 points out of a playoff spot. The Flyers were only 7. They could, you know, try and make the argument that they're still sort of in the hunt and a win would be important to
them. Their compete level in that game, from start to finish, was embarrassing. If I was a Flyers fan, I would not be happy with the way they played last night.
Yeah, I wrote the term biteless. They had no bite. It looked like there was zero. You know, you expect the Flyers, the Philadelphia Flyers, to come out and, you know, if the offense isn't there, they're going to be either smashing you into the boards or trying to agitate you or get you off your game. But that just looked like a defeated Flyers team that really kind of realize that they have nothing left to play for this season. You kind of saw the defeat on the ice, and it was as if the Jets were kind of waiting for the attack of the Flyers to come out, and, you know, so they sit back, they'll weather the storm, and then, you know, kind of counter. And it was as if the Flyers were waiting for the Jets to attack, and neither team really wanted to engage for the first 10-15 minutes, and that's what resulted in that first period.
Imagine if you were a paying customer at that game last night. I mean, at least the game on Sunday against the Wild that the Jets won. And that makes it, you know, three in a row for the Jets now, having won Sunday, having won the previous Thursday in Long Island, having won last night against the Flyers. At least the Sunday game against the Wild, there's more of an atmosphere because there's a lot of Wild fans who've come up. The Wild are a divisional opponent. They're battling. They want to win the Central Division. They're struggling. You want to play a little bit of spoiler. It was 4-0, then it was 4-all, then it was 5-4 Jets. So there's at least a little bit of a entertainment factor in Sunday's game against the Wild. There was no entertainment factor last night. What? That was lousy hockey played by two teams that would much rather have been on the golf course.
And you got to give the Jets credit because they had a depleted defense corps. Yeah. You had no Toby Enstrom. You had no Jacob Trouba. No Paul Postma. No Ben Chiarot. I mean, it was nice to see Nelson Nogé get his first NHL game in.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, for the Flyers, I mean, you're looking over at that Jets roster and you're saying, four of their top defensemen are out of the lineup. We got to take advantage of that. Plus, the Jets' backup goaltender was in net, right? So, again, I'm not taking anything away from Michael Hutchinson. Nice for Michael Hutchinson. He picks up his sixth win. But you're not exactly facing, you know, Sergei Bobrovsky in net, right? So I think the Flyers' 10-game winning streak earlier in the season really flattered them. Because, you know, I look at where they are in the standings right now. I think they should be dead last in the Eastern Conference. I just thought they looked horrible.
Well, we had Anthony Sanfilippo on the show on Saturday. And Anthony has covered the Flyers and covered the Philly sports scene for, you know, a long time now. Probably a decade, 15 years. And he said this is a team that's in dramatic need of changes. And more than just, you know, cosmetic changes. He said that the coach probably needs to go back to not being an NHL head coach, which is a strong comment to hear.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and I really like Dave Haxtell. I mean,
yeah,
he did a great job with the University
UNG
of North Dakota.
Sure.
And, you know, he had a good year last year. He got them into the playoffs last year, right? Even though they didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, they got into the playoffs last year really on the strength of a very late season run. They played well towards the end of
the
year.
And the East wasn't as good.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
you didn't have a team like the Columbus Blue Jackets in the mix, right?
Sure.
So, mm-hmm. But needless to say, I mean, it's falls on the coach when you have an effort like that, when you're fighting for your playoff lives. And, I mean, again, we can focus on the Jets and the good things. Shifley, Wheeler, and Perreault, I mean, they had a combined 8 points.
Yeah.
They looked great. And, you know, there were some great individual performances. Buff played 28 minutes. He looked great out there. But
the Flyers made it easy on him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask you guys this, and we'll talk about, Nelson Nogé. You mentioned he got his first NHL game in last night. He played 12 minutes and 16 seconds.
Looked pretty good, Drew.
Your mm-hmm. thoughts on him?
He played 12 minutes. And he was paired up with Mark Stewart.
Yeah.
And he's a guy that this is his first professional year with the Manitoba Moose. And, you know, his point totals haven't been maybe what you'd expect because he does have a little bit of an offensive upside. But he projects as more of a defensive defenseman. It's good defenseman. And, you know, he's got some size, a little bit of skill. And he likes to, you know, use his body a little bit. So, you know, good for him. He's a guy that I don't think is going to be a full-time NHL or anytime soon. But because of injuries, he's getting an opportunity. And he didn't look out of place as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, it was a nice story. His folks were drove down from Saskatchewan and made the game. And he got kind of thrown into the fire right off the bat. Opening, you know, nice little gesture by the Jets, putting him as a starter. And puck gets one to him right away, and he has to make a couple quick decisions along the wall in his own zone. So he's kind of getting thrown into the fire right off the bat for the kid, but he handled himself well. He seems to be a very smooth skater, and one thing I really liked about him is that he didn't force anything. Usually when you're a young guy, you know, sometimes you can make the wrong read quickly because everything's happening so fast. But when he didn't recognize and he didn't see anything that he liked, he just kind of used his legs. He's a really good skater. And he just kind of crossed over the red line and dumped the puck in, and he made the smart, simple plays. And that's what he would say. He said in his pregame interviews that he just has to keep his game simple and kind of stick to what he knows.
And this wasn't a high draft pick, guys.
No, like, it was fourth round?
Yeah, and this isn't a guy that put up big numbers in the Western Hockey League. So for him, this is a big deal to play his first NHL game, and I think it's going to definitely help him in his development. Again, I would expect him to play the majority of next season with the Manitoba Moose, but
sure,
he's young. He's 20 years old, so maybe, you know, 2 or 3 years down the line, you know, he gets a little bit more of an opportunity with the Jets. But, you know, as Rick said it on the post-game show, it really was Nelson Nogé night last night.
That's quite the mouthful to say, Nelson Nogé night.
Yeah, triple N.
Yeah, triple N. Question for you boys. Jets power play last night, successful 1 out of 6 times. They got that one power play goal to start the game. That was the Matthew Perreault tip on the Blake Wheeler shot.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts, or give me a reason why the Jets power play is better with Patrick Laine on the right side half boards than the left side half boards.
I don't like him there. And I don't know if that's going to be something that we see long term because we've only got 9 games left.
I don't think it is.
But I think he's much more effective on the left point. But you look at the way that Blake Wheeler is shooting the puck on the left point.
Right, but they're playing on different power play units anyways.
No, I'm just saying, I mean, sometimes you're going to possibly see both of those guys out there on the first power play unit, right? Not right now, but I'm just saying.
Well, Patrick, I mean, you can certainly make the argument that Patrick Laine deserves first power play unit time. And so when
well,
I'm asking.
I don't even think it's an argument.
Argument for everybody besides Paul Maurice. But, I mean, asking you guys, you know, take away that factor for a second. Forget about that. Let's pretend he was playing.
He should be on the left point.
On the left half wall. He's playing on the right side half wall. Are the Jets not just taking away one of the biggest weapons in the league and sort of saying, perform with one hand tied behind your back?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting scenario that you have right now with the Jets' power play because the Jets' power play has actually looked really good, and they only scored one goal, as you mentioned, Drew, but on that double minor, it was Ivan Provorov that high-sticked Mark Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that they looked really good moving the puck around. I mean, the Jets' power play, you can see, is going to get better. I mean, it's I think, middle of the pack right now. I don't know what it is exactly. It fluctuates from game to game, but certainly Blake Wheeler is not a guy that you expect to have that big blast from the point, but he's the guy that's really kind of setting the tempo for the power play. But
Jets power play is 23rd in the NHL now.
I didn't realize it was that bad.
Yeah.
So when you talk about Patrick Laine, I mean, I haven't broken down the numbers as far as how many goals he scored on the right point or the right half boards. I don't think it's very many.
Well, he hasn't scored a goal, and I believe it was the last three games he hasn't scored a goal.
He hasn't scored a power play goal since the new year.
Really?
I believe mid-November was the last time he scored. Early December, possibly, was the first time last time he scored a power play goal.
He's got some nice assists, though.
He's got some nice goals.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Well, and that's the part that I find completely inexplicable, is that, and I've heard the argument, or I've heard the comment be, well, the opponents were keying on him, and they were preventing him from being as effective. Well, let your opponents key on him. If they want to, you know, shift their attention away, that should just leave more room on the ice for your other players to be able to control a power play opportunity.
Yeah, but teams, Drew, have been doing that with Alexander Ovechkin since he came into the league.
And he still finds ways to score.
Yeah, and that's, he finds ways to score, and that allows other guys to be open, right?
That's what I'm saying.
Nikolai Ehlers or whether that's Dustin Byfuglien.
That's why it's inexplicable that you would play into your opponent's hand and willingly neuter this weapon. So, you know, if
he
you're...
Let's be honest. He rang one off the post last game.
I'm not saying so that this
is...
Like,
I don't mind like the shooting angle chances. From the right side.
It's on his...
I don't mind the shot, to be honest. Like we can break down the one-timer is sexy and everything, but with 9 games left, give him a different look. I mean, like, he's been there since, what, November?
I like that wrist shot, the best shot. I think his wrist shot is actually his best shot, not his slap shot.
It's amazing.
That's what I'm saying. I don't understand why you would put him into a less of a position to succeed than. And so, who cares if your opponents are focusing on him?
And that's why, Drew, I don't think it's permanent. I think
it's definitely not permanent.
He hasn't been scoring on the left point, so Paul Maurice is trying him out right now. And I guess at this point in the season, when your chances of making the playoffs are very slim, now is probably the time you want to do it, right?
Maybe Patrick Laine asked to move. Who knows? I doubt it.
I doubt it, too. Yeah. I just don't understand. I think it's inexplicable. I mean, I don't care how significant his struggles have been on the power play. I don't think they've been that significant. I just find the idea of weakening your power play under any circumstances. I don't care if there's 9 games left in the season or if there's 9 minutes left in the season. I think putting him on the... I mean, there's a reason why you don't see Alex... there's a reason why you know where Alex Ovechkin is on each and every power play.
Drew, I wouldn't get too excited. I would expect them to put Patrick Laine at a certain point back on the left side. Mm-hmm. And regardless of what side he's on, he's going to score goals.
Wow.
So don't worry about that.
I'm not worried about him scoring goals. I'm just trying to understand the logic of the coaching staff in that decision. And that's what no one has been able to adequately, you know, give me an explanation that I would accept as reasonable in this instance. In any event, let's go to break. When we come back, we'll talk about the up-to-date Craigslist that Craig Button released. We'll pose the question, is it time for the Jets to maybe consider parting with their first-round pick for a ready-made solution? Much more to come. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290.
No Kirkpatrick still number one. Nico Hischier still number two. Who's at number three?
Martin Nakash. He's playing in the Czech Extra League, which is the Czech Senior League, the Pro League. And boy, is he a really talented player, dynamic. And once that physical maturity comes along, he's only going to be that much better. He reminds me so much, Gino, of Claude Giroux. He's got the ability to skate. He's got the ability to make plays. He can shoot the puck. But he's really dialed in competitively. And when I start to look at this draft and I see a centerman like Martin Nakash, I think there's every reason to get excited and think that's a player that can make a real difference to a team.
20 minutes after the top of the hour, you're listening to NHL This Week. The segment brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets for a list of performers and showtimes, visit RumorsComedyClub.com. Tonight at Rumors, she's there all week. She tore the place down last night. You still have time to get tickets. Showtime, 8 p.m. Miss Pat is in town. Check her out, RumorsComedyClub.com.
Did Mr. Pat come to Winnipeg too, Drew?
I don't know if Mr. Pat came with her or not, but she's quite funny. I have seen some of her material. I would recommend it. You're a bachelor right now. Your significant other is away. So, you know, if you're looking for something to do rather than, you know, eat McDonald's and cry into it, when you're done with it, you can check out Miss Pat at Rumors and you'll be crying out of laughter instead of loneliness.
I'd love to go see Miss Pat. She was actually at Virgin headquarters today.
That's right. She was on air earlier this afternoon with the team at the studio a couple doors down from us. So there you go. You can go check her out. Craigslist, Craig Button comes out with his new Craigslist earlier today. No surprise, Nolan Patrick of the Brandon Wheat Kings.
Drew, have you ever put anything on Craigslist?
I sold a couch on Craigslist.
Really? Not Kijiji?
Actually, it might have been Kijiji now that you mention it.
Okay.
Because Craigslist is more American than Kijiji is, right? Or is it the other way around?
No, I think it's...
I feel like Craigslist is like MySpace. I don't think anybody uses it anymore.
Oh, really?
No, I think people still do. Yeah, people use it.
Maybe I don't remember if it was Kijiji.
The only Craigslist I use is Craig Button's draft list.
Yeah, that's about it. I think it was Kijiji. I actually sold a car in Kijiji too.
Really?
Yeah, my old car. It was a good car.
Did you get a nice price?
I got a decent price for it. Yeah, it was my grandparents' car, and given that they were elderly, they didn't drive it very much. So the car itself was, 15 years old. I think 16 years old.
How many miles?
I think it had 30,000 kilometers on it.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was, you know, even though it was an old car, it was well worth the price for anybody buying it because it only had 30,000 kilometers on it.
And it for sure had a Kleenex box in it because all cars that are owned by old people have Kleenex boxes in it.
This is the time where I would tell you that my car currently has a Kleenex box in it because you never know when you're going to need to blow your nose.
So does mine.
Yeah, I mean, a Kleenex box, you have to blow your nose.
Are we talking like one of those little Kleenex packages or
it's a full box on the floor.
I go full.
Yeah.
See, I don't do that because then the Kleenex box can get dirty.
Yeah, it's true. It can happen. Yeah. You're right. I mean, it's probably more sanitary to do it your way. Mind you, you're the same person who just ate a donut off the floor before the show started. So, you know, you win some, you lose some in life. Nolan Patrick, number one on the Craigslist ranking. Brandon Wheat Kings, of course. You know, he's a slow start to the year with the injury, but he's picked it up tremendously.
Playoff
since then.
Start this week for the Wheat Kings.
There you go. Patrick, he's got 46 points in only 33 games.
Yep.
Nico Hischier of the Halifax Mooseheads. It's the Nico versus Nolan draft. Nolan versus Nico. He's the clear-cut number two. Question I have for you guys, less so about debating about these players, because I know you probably haven't seen a ton of on them. Depending on where the Jets land in the draft lottery, is this the year where the Jets should consider trading that first-round pick? You know, maybe it's sixth, maybe it's eighth, maybe it's tenth. Is this the year the Jets should consider trading a first-round pick for a ready-made solution to some of the problems that ail the team?
Drew, it all depends what you're trading that first-round pick for. Because we know that right now, heading into the offseason, the two biggest needs for the Jets are a veteran goaltender and I would say a top-four defenseman. And a lot of needing a top-four defenseman, I think, also revolves around whether or not Jacob Trouba is going to be signed to another long-term contract. I should say a long-term contract, because he's got one more year left on his contract. So I think, first off, we haven't seen the Jets trade their first-round pick since they came over from Atlanta, right?
You don't see teams trade their first-round pick very often.
That's true.
Yeah.
So if you're going to trade a first-round pick, most likely you're going to have to trade a prospect and another player to acquire the player that you want. So whether that's a veteran goaltender or a top four defenseman, left shot defenseman, we should mention, right? Because the Jets are more comfortable right now with what they have on the right side. That includes Tyler Myers. Now, there's also the expansion draft to consider, right? Are the Jets going to protect four defensemen? Are they going to protect three defensemen? So
I think it's pretty clear that they're going to protect four defensemen. Well, I don't see a way that they're not going
to... None of us know
that. None of us know that for sure, but I don't see a way that they're not going to protect Tyler Myers and Jacob Trouba.
I agree with you. Yeah. I think they're going to go option two, Drew.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about the original question was, are the Jets going to trade their first-round pick?
And should they? Should they consider it? Yeah.
And when you look at where they're most likely going to draft, they're probably not going to get the second overall pick like they did last year. So most likely, based on where they are in the standings now, they're going to pick in between 6 and 10. I think that would be fair to say.
I think somewhere in that vicinity.
Maybe as high as 5, depending on what happens in the last 9 games here.
Yeah, well, I think if the season ended today, they would have the 8th overall pick if the season ended today and nobody moved in the standings. It would actually be 9th. Because Las Vegas is guaranteed to not pick, I think, below 4th, if I'm not mistaken.
So let's say they're going to pick then maybe between 7 and 10.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's not going to be a high draft pick. We know that this draft isn't considered to be as strong as the 2015 or 2016 drafts, right?
Right.
It's basically Nolan Patrick, Nico Hischier, and then there's a pretty big drop-off with like 3 and 4 with, you know, Gabe Vilardi and some other guys. So
yeah. Martin Nekash.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about whether or not the Jets are going to trade their first-round pick, I have absolutely no idea. For me, the only way Kevin Cheveldayoff trades his first-round pick is if he makes a move that is going to significantly improve the Jets next year. Again, whether that's trading that first-round pick for a goalie or trading that first-round pick for a defenseman, because I don't think the Jets are going to trade the first-round pick with a player and a prospect to acquire forward. We know the Jets are pretty set at forward. Top six forwards look pretty good right now, right? And then you throw in maybe Kyle Connor into the mix next year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily know that the Jets are in the market for a top six forward. So, I mean, again,
you're right. It would be to address the biggest issue on the team, and the biggest issue clearly on this team is left side defense and goaltending.
Right. And I don't want to give you a cop out answer. I think the answer is yes, as far as the Jets need to trade something to acquire something to upgrade those two positions. So whether that's a first round pick or that's a prospect, so you can throw in Kyle Connor, Nick Batan, Jack Roslovic. I mean, the Jets have to address the goaltender position, and I think their top 4D has to be better. So is that trading a first-round pick? Might be. Might not be. It might be trading, you know, a couple of prospects.
Sean?
Yeah, I agree that, you know, under normal circumstances, I would be opposed to trading a top-round pick. But in a year like this year, you look at the top 10, it's only 2 defensemen out of the top 10. So let's say even if the Jets draft top 10, you're going to only have two essential chances for this ranking to bring in a top defensive prospect. So regardless of that, you got to address what you need moving forward. Like we talked about, defense, goaltending. I think this is the year that the Jets, Kevin Cheveldayoff needs to do something to improve this roster next year. This same product on the ice next year is inexcusable.
Well, and the problem that, sorry, Sean, for interrupting, but the problem is, you know, and if you don't go out and address, there's nobody coming up in the pipeline to help you on your left side of the defense.
Exactly. So let's say you get the 7th overall pick of the draft this year. Why not try to package together one of your prospects that you don't feel has an immediate future with the team? You know, this team is stockpiled with forward talent at the depth position. You know, the Moose, they've got a variety of forwards too that not quite sure where they fit in with this Jets roster moving forward. So, I mean, if you can package together a first and a couple forward prospects, I mean,
I don't think you, I'm not talking that it has to be a blockbuster trade.
No, absolutely not. But you address what you need to take care of moving forward so that next year these same issues don't present themselves.
But, Drew, for example, if you want to get Marc-Andre Fleury,
yeah,
the Penguins aren't going to do the 7th overall pick for Marc-Andre Fleury. You're going to have to throw in something else.
Hang on. I think they would. I think they would do less for Marc-Andre Fleury simply because they don't have another option. They can't let Matt Murray be exposed in the expansion draft. So why would you offer a king's ransom for Marc-Andre Fleury?
Marc-Andre Fleury is maybe a bad example.
Sure, okay.
A number one goaltender.
Well, you know, I don't think that, and I actually don't think the Jets are going to.
Let's take the expansion draft out of it. I know it's hard to. It gets a little bit complicated.
I wouldn't, you know, I don't think that I don't think the Jets are necessarily going to. I think if they were to use this pick and maybe put it up on the trade block, I think it would be more for a defenseman than it would be for a goaltender, because I think they can address the goaltending through unrestricted free agency. You look at the goaltenders.
We went over the goaltenders. Aside from Ben Bishop and a couple of other goaltenders, how many really good goaltenders are going to be UFAs?
Well, Ben Bishop, Brian Elliott's going to be a UFA, Ryan Miller, although he's supposed
Calgary,
to not.
But you got to think Calgary's going to re-sign Elliott. Why wouldn't they?
You would think they would, but you never know. I mean, I'm just saying, you know, you would think that he would re-sign there. I wouldn't expect him to go to unrestricted free agency. But if I'm the Jets, I mean, who are you going to trade for from a goaltending perspective? Like, which goalie is going to command a first-round pick in exchange?
Well, but that's what I'm saying. I mean, if you're talking about whether or not the Jets are going to trade a first-round pick, it has to be to get a number one goaltender.
I think it has to be to get a number one or a number two left side defenseman. Mm-hmm. I think you can address
goaltending was a bigger issue than left side D.
I think you can address. I don't disagree, but I think you can address the goaltending issue with either less than a first round pick if you make a trade or free agency. I don't think that a first round pick is going to be what it takes to solve your goaltending conundrum.
Well, it may or may not be. I mean, you might have to trade a roster player, right?
You might. You're right. I mean, we obviously don't know the answer to this question, but I don't think that it's going to. Marc-Andre Fleury, if the Penguins get closer and closer to the expansion draft and they haven't solved their issue, they're not going to be able to command a ransom for Marc-Andre Fleury simply because teams won't pay it because they know they're in a rock and a hard place when it comes to Matt Murray being exposed. So why would anybody go to the Penguins and offer up a big package if you know that the Penguins have to expose Matt Murray?
You're fixating on Marc-Andre Fleury. I mean,
he's the only goaltender that's on the market, on the trade market, that's going to cost you that much.
Well,
Yaroslav Halak, if you get him out of Islanders, isn't going to cost you much.
There's going to be other goaltenders that are backups right now that won't be selected by Vegas.
Sure.
So UC Saros.
Yeah, but he's not going to cost you a first-round pick.
Well, what are you going to get? What would Columbus take for UC Saros? A seventh-round pick?
I think. Well, what would the Islanders take for Yaroslav Halak? I think they would take.
Ask Garth Snow.
I think they would take a third or a fourth-round pick and say, "Get the contract off my books." They're not going to. Well, nobody's going to pay a first-round pick for Yaroslav Halak.
Well, I didn't say they would.
I know that you wouldn't, but I'm saying a first-round pick, I think, is going to solve your left-side defensive issues, not your goaltending issues, is what I'm saying, is what I think.
It's possible. Yeah, I don't think they're going to end up trading their first-round pick, by the way.
Well, then.
They haven't done it so far.
And you're right. And given how conservative the team is, and draft and develop, draft and develop, draft and develop, there's no reason to think they're going to, you know, change from that point of view. We will find out closer to the start of the draft. Let's head to break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Lisa Dillman of NHL.com. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Show this week with the Illegal Curve returns on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
You're listening to NHL This Week. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you here in studio at TSN 1290. Trying to get in touch with Lisa Dillman to talk about the LA Kings, the Jets and the Kings tomorrow evening in Los Angeles. Disappointing season for the Kings. I know they've been without Jonathan Quick for the majority of the year. But this LA Kings team, I think, as currently designed, I think something needs to change on this LA Kings team. They just don't seem like they are the perennial threat to the Chicago Blackhawks that they were just a couple of seasons ago. They seem like they've taken a significant step back in the Western Conference and have been passed, I would suggest, by the Sharks and the Ducks. I would say they probably are not, maybe on the, they might be on the verge of being passed by the Oilers and the Flames as well. This LA Kings team seems like they're in a bit of a rut where they, you know, yeah, they can, they're probably good enough to make the playoffs most seasons. But I'm not sure that they're a good enough team to really be a Stanley Cup contender anymore.
Well, they might not even make the playoffs, right? And Jonathan Quick's injury I think, what did he miss, 59 games, Drew, something like that?
Yeah.
And, you know, Peter Budaj did a pretty admirable job replacing Jonathan Quick, and then they went out before the trade deadline and it acquired Ben Bishop. But for me, this team just doesn't defend well enough, and they don't score enough goals. Andrei Kopitar has had a pretty weak year, mm-hmm. and, you know, Jeff Carter's had a great year. You know what you're going to get out of Jeff Carter, but the secondary scoring just hasn't been there. And when you talk about, you know, the Kings-Oilers game recently, the Kings just look slow, and the Oilers shut out the LA Kings. And, you know, when you're talking about, you know, what was the strength of the LA Kings, it was defense. And, you know, Jonathan Quick, I think, has been okay since he returned. But when you're talking about why they probably haven't done as well as you'd expect, I would look right at, you know, the guys that get paid the big money. And Andrei Kopitar is a great two-way center. But certainly right now, it's going to be tough. They're 8 points out of it right now.
Yeah.
They've got the same amount of games played as the Nashville Predators. So it's an uphill climb.
I think, even though they would never admit as such, I think they are playing for next year at this point in time. But that's my point about the Kings, is that even playing for next year, I look at this roster and I don't see how they're anything but sort of a fringe playoff team, even with a healthy Jonathan Quick for an entire season. Because it's not like Peter Budaj struggled with the Kings. He was way better than they could have ever hoped for. I just look at their roster, and I think it's a flawed roster. And you spoke to the lack of foot speed, and you spoke to the down year that Andrei Kopitar is having. And
look at Marian Gaborik was injured. He hasn't had a very good year.
Yeah, but how much can you really expect out of Marian Gaborik at this point in his career?
Well, they signed him to a big contract.
I think they're probably regretting that.
No, it wasn't a good contract.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have Tanner Pearson and you have Tyler Toffoli, who are both pending RFAs.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a lot of work to do in the offseason here. But when you're talking about, you know, some of the other players, Dustin Brown's actually had a bounce back year after having a few down years. But again, when you look at the team that went all the way to the Stanley Cup and won it in 2012 and 2014, right? You've still got the same defensemen signed long term, Jake Muzzin, Drew Doughty, and Alec Martinez. But when you get down to, you know, the third pair, you had guys like Willie Mitchell and Matt Green and Robin Regier. Remember, like, this was a team that was really tough to play against, and they just didn't give you a lot. And, you know, we've seen the Jets play the Kings in recent years, and they're just not as hard a team to play anymore.
I mean, obviously, there's clear reasons why he's no longer with the team, but they do miss Slava Voynov. They miss him on the back end, and what he was able.
And they miss Voynov. They miss Regier. They miss Willie. Like,
yeah,
they had the best group of defensemen, with maybe the exception of the Chicago Blackhawks, in the entire league.
Yeah,
and right now it's still a decent group of defensemen. Well, but
they have a good
shadow of its former self.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, Doughty is still Drew Doughty, and Jake Muzzin is, you know, most, you know, all teams would take Jake Muzzin.
Drew Doughty took a bad elbow from Matthew Tkachuk last game.
And we'll talk about that coming up. But we'll talk about that next segment, in fact. We'll talk about Matthew Tkachuk and his play on the edge, let's say, coming up on the program. But I just look at this Kings team, and I see them as flawed, and I'm not sure how they solve the problems that that are rearing their head. I mean, they certainly don't have a lot of salary cap space, that's for sure.
Yeah, they're pinched when it comes to the money. And you just, when you watch the LA Kings, and you just kind of think to yourself, man, has this team slowed significantly? Like you were talking about, Drew, they used to just be this hard-nosed team that would come in and just beat you down, and you win or lose, you'd leave with some bruises. And now they kind of look like they're in that transition, and they don't really know which direction they want to go. If they want to focus on goal scoring, or they want to focus on that big bruising identity that they're used to. And like you said, the defense is kind of all over the place. Drew Doughty's playing with a rookie, Derek Forbort. So, you know, he's compensating for someone who's learning their ways right now. And
the Kings are 27th in the NHL in goals for. And it's certainly not a new struggle for the LA Kings to, you know, to say that they're having trouble scoring goals. The problem is that, you know, when you are so tight to score goals, I think it eventually wears on the players, because they know that they find it so difficult to score. And you need those sort of, you do need some games where it's not life and death to score enough goals to win. And when that's sort of how your team is built, and they're built in a manner where it's life and death to score goals, that we're not going to score, so we're going to have to try and grind it out and be desperate to not give up any more than we absolutely can, I think it gets tiring on the players. I think what you're seeing that is that year after year after year now that they've had this difficulty scoring goals, I think it's beginning to wear on the LA Kings players.
And, And if you don't get the goaltending you're used to in those situations and you go down one, two goals quickly in games and you're having trouble scoring, mentally that starts to take a toll on you as well when you're like, okay, well, now we got to score three and we're averaging however many, 1 point, whatever. And that.
Well, I mean, but they're still, they're sixth. I mean, the way I look at it, they're sixth in the NHL in goals against. So they definitely still are good at keeping the puck out of their net. But you look at the teams that are around there that are, you know, just ahead of them. I mean, the Washington Capitals, they score a ton of goals. So they have the best of both worlds, mm-hmm. of course. The Columbus Blue Jackets, they score a ton of goals. San Jose Sharks score, they're going to be over 200 goals this year. You know, the Ducks, you know, they don't score a ton, but they score more than the Kings. The Wild score a ton. So, I mean, the LA Kings need an influx of offense, not to change anything on the way they play on the defensive side of the game, because, you know, they obviously play a fantastic defensive side. But they need an influx of offense just to make it easier on their players on a night-in, night-out basis. Otherwise, the 82 games is almost too much of a grind for them.
And imagine where they'd be if Peter Budaj didn't come in this year and play miraculously.
That's what I'm saying, is that, so yeah, you can point to the absence of Jonathan Quick as a factor in the fact they're not going to make the playoffs, but it wasn't a huge step down mm-hmm. between Quick and Budaj this year.
Budaj was unbelievable.
Of course, he was fantastic for them. So that's the problem that I think the LA Kings are going to run into a long term, is that where does the offense come from? Because the roster isn't going to change dramatically. There's still going to be, you know, it's still going to be Anže Kopitar. It's still going to be Jeff Carter. Pearson and Toffoli, will re-sign. Those are still going to be the guys there. But are they good enough to score goals for the Kings, enough to make them into a real playoff contender? I think the answer is no right now.
Yeah, and the Kings miss Milan Lucic, and so you're probably going to have to address that in the offseason. And it's going to be difficult because you're up against the salary cap. But certainly right now, not only might they not make the playoffs, but it's a team that, even if they do squeak in, are they going to go anywhere, right?
I just don't see that they're going to have that possibility of going anywhere. They don't score enough goals. They don't have enough offense. And I think the problems are for the Kings, more so than this year. Because you could have made the argument that this year is a bit of a wash when Quick went down with the injury. The problems are in years to come, because I don't see where this influx is. It's not like they have a pipeline of prospects, you know, like the Jets do with Connor and Roslovic, who are likely to be top six NHL forwards. The Kings are a little barren in terms of their drafting, which I guess is a testament to how well they've been as a franchise for the last 5 years, 10 years. Mm-hmm. But at some point in time, something's got to give, and they're going to need to get offense from somewhere. But when you can't really make the moves on the with the salary cap, it puts them in a really difficult situation.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. And it's going to be really interesting to see what if anything they address in free agency in the offseason. I mean, bringing Jerome McGinley in to address your offensive needs isn't exactly a blockbuster move at the trade deadline. And it's going to be real interesting to see if someone gets shipped out, or what the roster looks like entering next season with regards to some of their UFAs. So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting offseason for LA.
When we come back, we'll discuss that Matthew Tkachuk hit on Drew Doughty from earlier this week. Tkachuk got suspended for 2 games. One of the dirtiest players in the league, Drew Doughty says.
Speaking
interesting
of
that, comments.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290.
This week with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
Calgary's Matthew Tkachuk has been suspended 2 games by the NHL for this nasty elbow on LA defenseman Drew Doughty. Tkachuk did not receive a penalty on the play, but I mean, he really popped him after the game. Doughty said Tkachuk is a pretty dirty player, and to be a rookie playing that way was surprising. Tkachuk leads all rookies with 96 penalty minutes so far this season.
Tkachuk leads all rookies in penalty minutes, as you just heard Darren Dattishan talking about there in that clip. 10th overall in the NHL in penalty minutes, 4th in minor penalties, certainly making an impact on the score sheet and in the penalty box this year, Matthew Tkachuk for the Calgary Flames. Welcome back to NHL This Week. This segment is brought to you by Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. For more information, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. So we'll talk about Tkachuk, his play this season. First of all, How dirty was that elbow? 2 games suspension worthy? Is that the did the Department of Player Safety get that right, Ezzy, with the 2 games for Tkachuk for that elbow?
No, I think he should have got more. And what's probably the most surprising is that there was no penalty called on the play, right?
The ref is literally standing right in front of him.
I don't know how there isn't a penalty called there. And, you know, there's a little bit of a, you know, a scrum afterwards with Derek Forbort and Matthew Tkachuk. And, you know, Matthew Tkachuk likes to play with an edge. Keith Tkachuk, his dad, also played with a bit of an edge. But it's surprising to me that he only got 2 games because you're talking about Drew Doughty, right?
Sure.
You know, you usually expect kind of the superstar players to be protected a little bit more. And
in every other league besides the NHL.
And it shouldn't be like that. I mean, all players should be treated equally, but we know that that always isn't the case. So I think he probably should have got 5 games. And it doesn't set a good precedent, but if you look at all of the other incidences throughout this year and going back to the previous couple of years, I mean, the NHL could end up, you know, giving a lot of players harsher sentences. So, I mean, Drew Doughty could get seriously injured there. He could get knocked out. I mean, that's a vicious elbow. He stops up,
break his jaw,
sees Drew Doughty, and elbows him. And, I mean, hockey's a tough game and all that. I appreciate that. But, I mean, Matthew Tkachuk knew what he was doing. So, no, I thought 2 games wasn't enough.
Shawnee?
Yeah, I'm going to agree. I think it should have been at least 4, specifically because, A, head targeted. I know the Matthew Tkachuk kind of defended the action by saying what he calls the reverse hit, where you see the guy coming and you initiate the contact to avoid getting hit. And yeah, that's a fine and dandy excuse, but you don't really do that with your elbow.
Yeah, you don't do that by flailing your elbows wildly.
Yeah, and you watch that clip. We've broke it down. I've watched it so many times. It's a direct, like, there's no brush off of the shoulder with momentum. No momentum. Keep physics out of it. This is a blatant elbow to the face of a rookie to a Stanley Cup winning Olympic champion, veteran player in the league, highly regarded, who came out after and calls out the league, calls out the kid, and it's a real dirty play. And in a league that's trying to focus on headshots and concussion awareness and this and that, to have a 2-gamer for let me just say, he clean rap sheet to an extent. Matthew Tkachuk almost got suspended, where I have it here, back on January 23rd for a slew foot on Martin Marincin that was reviewed by the league. He was not suspended, no supplemental discipline, but it's not as if this was his first dirty play, you know? Like, he's been praised for playing on the line throughout the year, and he's had some great success. Matthew Tkachuk has been one of the great rookies of the year. But when you kind of get comfortable playing in that dirty kind of agitator role, sometimes you cross the line, and eventually that is going to catch up to him. I'm not saying retribution is coming, but when you have a reputation as a dirty young player taking liberties at some of the successful veterans around the league, you're going to get yours.
And, Sean, in a year where Evgeny Malkin doesn't get a single game for that hit to the head on Blake Wheeler, and Nazem Kadri only got, what was it, 1 game or 2 games for that hit earlier in the season. I forget who it was on now. But
One of the Sedins.
Right.
Daniel
Sedin? You could argue that.
They're the same person as far as I'm concerned.
Nazem Kadri should have maybe got 5 or 6 games for that. You could argue maybe he should get 10. I mean, if they really want to take this out of the game.
I don't think they do.
Well,
I mean, the evidence this year is that they don't really care, to take a lot of it out of the game. You mentioned Evgeny Malkin, and it's funny because the only player who has more minor penalties this year in the entire NHL than Matthew Tkachuk, among forwards, pardon me, the only forward who has more minor penalties than Matthew Tkachuk is Evgeny Malkin. So do the Flames maybe like this edge?
Oh yeah,
that Tkachuk plays with.
Well, yeah, they don't want him to necessarily not play with an edge or not play with that physical element to his game, Drew. But they also don't want him to be suspended, right? And you can't be a dirty player. There's a fine line between being a physical player and a dirty player, right? Mm-hmm. We've talked about that a lot. Like with Brad Marchand, he's a guy that, you know, many consider to be a dirty player.
Sure.
Dustin Byfuglien, I don't think, is a dirty player. He's been suspended before, but I wouldn't call him a dirty player.
No.
I think a guy like Alex Burrows is a dirty player. There, I think, are probably only maybe half a dozen to a dozen, I think, quote-unquote, dirty players in the league. And I don't think you want to get a reputation for that because, as we know, he's now got 1 suspension in his first year. They're going to factor that in next time he does something like this, and he'll probably get at least 4 or 5 games.
You're probably right. I find it interesting how, you know, we sort of differentiate between those who are dirty and those who play on the edge, let's say. I think a lot of players, you know, Corey Perry,
dirty.
Certainly a guy who I think would say, a lot of people would either say dirty or plays on the edge. I think there's a subconscious differentiation that's made. When you're a player who can score and who is a really, you know, one of your best players on your team, even if you might be dirty, I think a lot of people are willing to cut you some slack and just say you play on the edge. You know, a guy like Alex Burrows, who you mentioned earlier as, you know, doesn't have the scoring that a lot of, that Brad Marchand does.
Tom Sestito is a dirty
Tom
player.
Tom Sestito is a dirty
exactly
player.
Exactly who I was thinking
but
of.
The guys who play on the edge, I think, you know, a lot of, you know, if Evgeny Malkin, if his name was Gene, you know, Gene something another, and he wasn't an offensive dynamo, and he
Aren't
wasn't
you
one
supposed to change the guy's name because they call him Gino.
Okay, well, I mean, fine. Gino. If his name was
Michael,
Michael Malkin, and he was a fourth line
still
player,
still use the same last name.
You know what the point is? The point is
I'm
that
just bugging you, Jerry.
I know. The point is that I think a lot of people are willing to differentiate and say a guy just plays on the edge when he also has the offensive game to back it up, whereas a guy who doesn't have the offensive game and, you know, would be, if Matthew Tkachuk played like he did but didn't have the bona fides on the offensive side of the game, I think people would just say he's clearly a dirty player, not he plays on the edge.
You know, we've been doing the show for 8 years now, over 8 years.
We just celebrated our ninth year, didn't we? Or was that our eighth year anniversary?
No, that was Ocho.
Oh, right.
The cake was good.
I can't keep track.
Every single
year
there's
still some cake here.
Every single year we've done the show, guys, we have had one of these incidences, probably more like three or four of these a year, right? I think you'd agree with that, Drew?
Yeah, there's always hits and dirty plays we talk about, sure.
And so, I mean, I love the physical aspect of the game. I don't know how many times I can say that.
You've said it many times.
But I also don't want to see guys injured. And when you have that type of stuff in the game, guys are going to get injured.
So does Tkachuk need to change his style then, from your estimation?
No, he's effective. So I'm not saying he has to change his style completely, but he shouldn't be elbowing Drew Doughty in the head.
Well, I mean, but Malkin, you know, laid out, you know, with his hit on Wheeler. Does Malkin need to change? Does Corey Perry, who broke, you know, who slashed Matthew Perreault earlier in the year?
But again, that's that fine line between playing with an edge and then trying to injure guys.
Well, you can argue that both of those, you know, that the Malkin hit on Wheeler was an attempt to injure and that the Perry hit on Perreault was an attempt to injure. Do those guys need to change? I mean, I don't think that there's...
They don't need to change the style that they play. Like, you're never going to ask, if you're Paul Maurice, you're never going to ask Dustin Byfuglien to not play a physical brand of hockey, because that's what separates Dustin Byfuglien, and he's a big guy, right?
Right.
But you don't want
nobody
him
would
to be slashing guys in the back of the neck and tripping them into the boards.
I don't think anybody would say that Dustin Byfuglien really plays on the edge, though. I think Dustin Byfuglien is big and physical, but I wouldn't say that he plays on the edge. You never think that he's, you know, to me, on the edge means you're right on the cusp of being reckless with your actions. And I don't think Dustin Byfuglien, for his physicality.
Drew, 3 weeks ago, Dustin Byfuglien took out three players.
Right, but at no point in time did you think it was
dirty. He plays
dirty
with a physical edge.
Yes, but not with an edge where it would cross over to dirty. He plays because he's bigger than everybody else.
He's been suspended before.
I know he's been suspended before.
Again, I'm not saying he's a dirty player. I'm just saying,
if you went through the list of dirty
Buff
players,
is a pretty physical player.
Oh, 100%. But if you went through the list of players that are either dirty or on the edge of being dirty, I don't think Dustin Byfuglien is on that list. I think the guys we've already mentioned, the guys that come to mind, I mean, Tom Sestito is a dirty player because he's useless. I mean, he's useless. He's a useless hockey player, aside from what he did. You know, he came into that game between the Jets and the Penguins 2 weeks ago, and he played 4 minutes, and he got a game misconduct, and he injured, was it Toby Enstrom? And he's a useless player. A guy like Corey Perry is a player who's effective, and he plays on the edge. And he's very close to being dirty if he isn't.
I guess what I'm thinking of when you say play with a physical edge is he's a physical player that likes to hit guys.
No. And I'm saying it's not that you're necessarily a physical player who likes to hit guys, because there's a lot of players like that. It's
not as many as there used to be,
not
Drew.
As many as there used to be, fine. But it's a player that is always on the cusp of injuring an opponent. That's what I would call on the edge.
Didn't Buff just recently injure a Penguins defenseman?
Yeah, but he doesn't do it with anything that was remotely close to illegal. At no point in time would you watch, do you usually
yeah,
watch?
But again, I'm not thinking physical edge means bordering on illegal.
Well, that's what I am.
Well, I guess
instance,
we have a different definition.
I'm saying,
I see what your point is.
Physical, where you injure a guy? If you injure a guy because you're so physical and it's a clean body check, all the power to you. You've done your team a great service.
Scott Stevens was a clean hitter. He played with a physical edge.
Fine, but nobody ever really thought he was a dirty player.
No.
In this day and age, he of course would be a filthy player but it was a different era. But a guy like Corey Perry, a guy like Brad Marchand, a guy like Matthew Tkachuk, you know, is...
I don't think Buff is that far away from the players that you're naming.
He's top five in penalties.
I know, but do you ever watch Buff and think that his hits are dirty?
Yeah, but again, that's not what. Again, I don't know what we're kind of caught up in. In what I don't even know what we're arguing about anymore.
Well, I think we're arguing we're trying to determine the difference between.
Wasn't this segment about Matthew Tkachuk's suspension?
Yeah, we're trying to determine the difference between just being physical, and the difference between being on the edge.
The distinction between a lot of that comes with the stick work. I find when you're on the edge, and you're on that line between dirty and playing physical, I think the stick comes into effect a lot. Your stick work, it's just that's where you see the real grimy plays. I find the trips and the slook foots and the jabs and the spears. Like that's where that player really shows themselves.
Well, Corey Perry. I mean, his stick work on Matthew Perreault.
Exactly.
I mean, Corey Perry is a guy who's known for always taking an extra shot, often behind the official's back.
Remember the knee on Line A in the World Championships?
Sure, the knee on Line A. That's a good example there. He's a guy who plays
between the whistle, just knees the guy in the side of the knee.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the difference is between. I mean, be physical. If you can be physical and you can injure opponents left, right, and center by your physicality, but if it's legal physicality, I don't think that's on the edge. I think on the edge is where you're injuring a guy through an illegal hit.
Yeah,
or
hitting Matthew Perreault into pacing him into the wall on that play would have been physical, but the slash that broke his wrist was dirty. So that's kind of
that's how I'm distinguishing between the mm-hmm. two of them. Mm-hmm. In any event, as Matthew Tkachuk, was it fair to say he's dirty?
Yeah.
Is he?
And effective.
That play was dirty.
But you wouldn't go as far yet to say to saddle dirty reputation?
Well, he's a rookie forward, too. I mean,
too soon?
I mean, people call Corey Perry dirty, but I've always said I'll take him on my team any day of the week.
I'm not saying you wouldn't take him. Of course, I would take
Corey
Perry.
Same thing with Brad Marchand.
I would, of course. Cool. Okay. I would take them on my team any day of the week as well, but they probably are deserving of their dirty player reputation. That's not to say that you wouldn't want them on your team for, 82 games a year. In any event, let's head to break. When we come back, we'll talk about the Anaheim Ducks. The Jets are in Anaheim on Friday night. Hannah Spraker covers the Ducks for the4thperiod.com. She joins us next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290.
NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve returns on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Hour number two of NHL This Week starts now on TSN 1290. Drew Mindell, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome to the program Hannah Spraker. Hannah is the Anaheim Ducks reporter for the fourth period. She joins us from sunny California. Hannah, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Our pleasure to have you on. Talk about the Ducks, the Jets and the Ducks. Going to do battle Friday night in the Duck Pond, although I'm not even sure if that's what they still call it there. They should if they don't. Hannah, this Anaheim Ducks team sort of battling with the Edmonton Oilers and the Calgary Flames for the final two playoff spots in the Pacific Division and to determine which of the team might fall into the wild card spot. Is it important to the Ducks where they finish in the division? Do they have one matchup when it comes to the playoffs that they would find more appealing than another? Right now, they'd be set to meet the Connor McDavid Edmonton Oilers in the first round. Is that a matchup they're trying to avoid more than others, or would they rather see the Flames, or are they even okay dropping into a wild card spot and likely meeting the San Jose Sharks?
Oh, I don't think they want to drop into a wild card spot. I mean, I think the goal is to, you want to finish higher than lower, but I think based off of what Carlisle said, he didn't want to get in. He wants the team to get in, and I think Carlisle believes if they can get in, they can go far, and as long as the key players, Corey Perry, Ryan Getzlaf, they're just now starting to really show up. Really, they had a big slump at the beginning of the season. Kessler's always kind of been on top of his game. with, you know, some scoring slumps here and there, but I think we've seen recently that when the top three guys, Kessler, Getzlaf, and Perry, all show up, they're a force to be reckoned with. So I think that going into the playoffs, that's the key focus, more so than where they finish. It's are our key players here for depth? Are they really showing their true colors of who they can be? Because is their window closing or not? They're in their 30s now. So I think it's really more an issue of production than it is of where they finish in the standings.
Hannah, a couple days ago, Ducks head coach Randy Carlyle said that John Gibson still isn't practicing with the team, so I imagine Jonathan Bernier's going to get the start tonight against the Edmonton Oilers. How far away is John Gibson from returning to the lineup? Is it possible we don't see him until the playoffs?
I think that could be possible. I mean, with Gibson, he's prone to injury, and he's prone to a groin injury. So, I mean, that when you have a groin injury as a goaltender, that can pretty much be a death sentence. I've always been a little bit weary of the longevity of John Gibson as a starter because he hasn't played a full season because of injury. So I think they could save him for the playoffs. But Bernie has been great. I mean, in his last 10 games, he has 7 wins, 3 losses, averaging roughly a .940 save percentage. So I don't think they're too concerned with throwing Gibson right back into the mix.
Hannah, you literally took the words right out of my mouth. I was just going to ask you, is this year the resurgence year for goaltender Jonathan Bernier?
I think so. And it's been really exciting to see because you kind of see it was kind of the opposite when it comes to Frederick Anderson going to Toronto and then Bernier coming to Anaheim. I think it kind of shows you how important a defensive core is and how they are in front of you as a goaltender. And I think Bernier has definitely kind of got a lot more confidence with, you know, Cam Fowler, Manson, and, you know, Lindholm, all these guys in front of him protecting the net. So I think, you know, when you have a strong defensive core, and Anaheim is known for having a plethora of young defensemen, I think that definitely does kind of play into a goaltender's confidence and gives him kind of that ego boost to really be confident in between the pipes. And I think we're seeing it with Bernier. And I think it was kind of a struggle for Frederick Anderson over in Toronto at the beginning of the season because it's kind of flip-flopping.
Hannah Spraker's our guest on NHL This Week. We're discussing the Anaheim Ducks. Hannah covers the Anaheim Ducks for thefourthperiod.com. Hannah, Patrick Eaves was the big acquisition, the only acquisition the Ducks made in the period leading up to the trade deadline in around about a month ago or about 3 weeks ago, I guess, at this point in time. He's played... where did I have it? I had it right here. He's played 10 games for the Ducks so far. He's got 3 goals, 2 assists for 5 points. How's Patrick Eaves looked as a member of the Anaheim Ducks?
I like that acquisition. I think at first I was a little bit like, I don't know how that's going to work out. But I think he fits the Anaheim playing style. He's that kind of gritty player that we see Anaheim kind of flourishes with. You know, whether it was Patrick Maroon or, you know, whoever. That's the kind of playing style that Anaheim likes, and I think Eaves fits in well, and it's worked to help split up the whole Getzlaf-Perry situation, and that's something that I wanted to see happen personally for a while now, because, I mean, he kept them together for, I don't know, how many games, and there was just nothing happening, and then split them up, and now they're producing. So I think that's kind of helped a little bit fit more of the mold. I think there's still a missing piece, and I think that's where, you know, summer is going to be crucial for this team. But I think he's definitely doing his job, and he's doing what they brought him to Anaheim to do.
Hannah, a few days ago, Andrew Cogliano skated in his 776th consecutive game, which ties him for the 4th longest streak of all time. Do you think enough people around the NHL are talking about this? Do you think it's because in California that enough people are aren't talking about this because it's a pretty crazy milestone?
Yeah, I think, the problem is over here in California, it's not exactly a hockey market. I mean, you go to, you know, a grocery store here, you could walk by 3 hockey players, most people won't know who they are. You do that in Toronto, Montreal, there's a swarm of people. So I think just kind of, you know, the fact that Anaheim is not really a good hockey market, I mean, I don't think he gets the recognition that he deserves for this milestone, and I think that's true of a lot of Anaheim players. I think Jakob Silverberg's kind of underappreciated for the type of player he is. Rickard Rakell is now just kind of getting a lot of recognition. I mean, Patrick Laine has 33 goals this year. Rickard Rakell has 31, but you don't really hear much about Rickard Rakell because he's not in a big hockey market. Andrew Cogliano has done this huge milestone that I think if he were in a more hockey market team, he'd get a lot more recognition. But this guy is a workhorse. You see him get knocked in the teeth, pulls out his teeth, puts it on the bench, skates back out. Like, he does not stop. And I'm very excited to see how far he can take this streak. Especially, I mean, it just goes to show the training that these guys go through, because if you manage to do that many games without an injury, that's amazing. Like, as an athlete myself, I can't imagine going that many games without some kind of injury that keeps you out at least one game.
Hannah, there's been talks that Cam Fowler has begun preliminary talks. He's got 1 year left on his deal. I'm just curious, do you see this defenseman being a big part of the Ducks moving forward, or do you think that they've got something planned in store for maybe the expansion draft or free agency with regards to this defenseman?
I think it'd be smart to extend his contract. I think he's definitely now kind of coming into his own as a leader on this team, and I think that he has really, I did a poll on Twitter not too long ago, like, if the fans could pick who they wanted in the captaincy next year, if for whatever reason Getzloff got stripped of the C and Perry got stripped of the A, whatever, who would they want to see? And most people said Kessler with the C, and then Cogliano and Fowler with the A. So he's really kind of coming into this veteran leadership role, and I think he is a little bit underappreciated, I feel like, because there was so many trade talks and so much speculation earlier in the season. I don't think people really paid much attention to how much he shut that down and how much he became, I mean, Bob McKenzie called him untradeable on Twitter. So I think he's one of those key players who, I mean, he's, what, 25 right now. Defensemen tend to peak later than forwards do. And he's having a career season. I think they can expect to see more and more of Cam Fowler and continue to see him grow and flourish. And, I mean, people, when he came into Anaheim, when he was drafted, people were saying he's the next Scott Niedermayer. Is that true? I don't know. But he's definitely progressing more and more and more and becoming more of a leader on the team. I think it'd be wise to re-sign him and go forward and see where he can take this team in terms of a leadership role. Because, you know, Getzloff, Perry, Kessler, they're in their 30s, and they're kind of slow. Kessler, not so much, but, I mean, Perry's slowing down. I mean, we're not going to see the same Corey Perry as when we saw him in the Hart. So I think Cam Fowler is definitely kind of, if they decide to keep him, he is a big part of the future of the team.
Hannah, moving away from the Anaheim Ducks for a second, you had a really good article up on thefourthperiod.com. We linked it earlier today. It was about the U.S. women's hockey players and their dispute with USA Hockey. We actually had John Langle on the show on Saturday, and it was a really fascinating interview. What compelled you to write the article, and do you see this situation resolving itself before the Women's World Championships start?
Well, for me, as a woman who not only plays but writes and sees the bias that there is with women in sports, and it's not just true of hockey, it's true of most sports. You know, there's always the understanding that women don't know sports, or that, like, how can they know as much about sports or be good at sports, or women's sports are a joke. There's always been this bias, and I've fought that my entire life, as I've always been an athlete, so I know how that is firsthand. And I wrote in the article, like, I got asked to play on the men's football team in high school, and everyone freaked out and was like, whoa, that's crazy. But I was also top softball player and captain of our team, and no one cared. So it's just kind of like it really hit home for me seeing this, because it's kind of like women are kind of expected to have their success measured on a man's scale. And that's not necessarily true. With different, you know, genders, different body types, you know, it's not like a woman's going to jump on the U.S. men's team. It's, you know, it's, women should be successful in accordance to a woman's scale. And I don't think that it's fair that these athletes work so hard all year round and don't get – it's not as much the salary that bothered me so much as the equitable support. They don't get the same PR, staff, management, the travel, insurance. They don't get any of these things that the men's team gets. And when the men's team is, you know, mostly NHL players who get, you know, the minimum contract is, what, over $500,000 a year. And in the women's league, they get they cut their salary in half this past year. So they get, what, $5,000 to $10,000 a year? That's nothing. So when they're expected to not only commit their lives and play every single day, all day, training, and expected to win, which they have done. They're a killer team. And really, when it comes down to women's hockey, it's really U.S. and Canada. Like, that's really the competition. So when you're expecting your women to really stand up and shut down, you know, Team Canada, you should help them out. I mean, I would really like to see the NHL start to back the women's league and kind of really gain some more support and gain some more traction to not only the PR and the marketing, but give these girls some more games in these bigger stadiums. Give them the opportunity to style out and see what they can do instead of just automatically giving them the boot and automatically telling them, no, we don't think you'll sell out stadiums, so we're not going to give you the opportunity. So really, they're asking for just equal treatment. They're asking for an opportunity to succeed, and they haven't been given it. So that kind of hit home for me just because there's always going to be a bias, I think, about women in sports. And I don't think when they're so proven that they should have to continue to prove themselves more and more and more just to get fair treatment.
Hannah Spraker covers the Anaheim Ducks for thefourthperiod.com. You can read her piece about the U.S. Women's Olympic Hockey Team and their battle with USA Hockey on thefourthperiod.com as well. We'll also send out a link to it. Hannah, appreciate your time this evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure, Hannah. Take care. When we come back, we are going to discuss Bruce Arthur's latest column about the NHL. Is it, quote, fan-friendly enough? You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Big thanks to Hannah Spraker for joining us to talk about the Ducks. Still to come on the program, Joe Haggerty. He covers the Boston Bruins. He's going to join us at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to NHL This Week. This segment is brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. Remember, if you're looking for a place to catch the game, Bernstein's Deli's got big screen TVs, they've got cold brewskis, and they got delicious food. Bernstein's Deli in the Cordon Village Mall. Check them out, bernsteinsdeli.com. Gentlemen, interesting article. Not sure if you had the opportunity to read it. I hope you did in the course of your prep for the show. Interesting article that Bruce Arthur wrote, sort of comparing and contrasting the NHL and the NBA in terms of fan friendliness. And basically what Bruce, I would say his hypothesis or his conclusions are, is that while both games are, you know, they're good games, they're great games, they're great sports, the NBA is more fan friendly for their fans than the NHL is. That there's more going on in the course of an NBA season and the course of an NBA offseason, and that an average NBA game is more entertaining than that of an NHL game. Would you agree with Bruce Arthur? Reading through his article, what did you think of the opinions? What did you think about the opinion he put forward and the points he made when you read the article?
Well, first of all, I don't know if you necessarily have to pick the NBA or the NHL as far as one is more exciting than the other.
You don't have to.
We happen to be, well, I'm just saying, in this case, he's deciding to say that the NBA is more exciting, right?
Look, it's, and for you and me, and I assume you too, Sean, I mean, I'm not a big NBA guy. I'm always going to choose a hockey game over the NBA.
Right.
You know, just because basketball's never been a sport. I mean, college basketball, yes. NBA has never been a sport for the most part. I would never watch a random regular season, you know, NBA game between the Milwaukee Bucks and the
Detroit Pistons.
There you go, Detroit Pistons. But I would watch a random NHL game between the Detroit Red Wings and the San Jose Sharks.
Right, and we're obviously biased because it's a hockey show, but and I've never been to a live NBA game, so I'm not maybe the best person to compare the two. But, I mean, he's not just talking about the live experience, guys. He's talking about here, I think, how the NHL fails to market its superstar players, because he's talking about LeBron James and Steph Curry and how the NHL maybe should be marketing Connor McDavid and Austin Matthews better. And that's kind of one point that he touches on. And then he talks about how more big-name players aren't moved at the trade deadline. Well, I don't know when big-name players in the NHL have ever been moved at the trade deadline. Well, you just don't see it, especially in the salary cap era.
And on that, it doesn't restrict it to the trade deadline. He also talks about how LeBron James and James Harden and Kevin Durant have all changed teams in free agency in the last 5 years, whereas, you know, the guys we go crazy about come July 1st and NHL free agency usually aren't the superstars of the league. They're usually guys who are, you know, all due respect to a guy like Andrew Ladd or David Backes, they're relatively average players.
Since the Jets came back, Drew, I think we've only seen one summer where big names have moved. That was 2012 with Parise and Suter going to Minnesota. But aside from that, I agree with you. I mean, this year the big free agent acquisition is going to be Kevin Shattenkirk, right?
He was the big acquisition at the trade deadline, and right. Yeah, he's probably the biggest name, right, quote unquote, on the market.
So yeah. That's not Connor McDavid, that's not Sidney Crosby. I mean, you're not going to see that. I mean, you're going to see teams lock up these players, right? Mm-hmm. And Connor McDavid, after his entry level deal is done, actually they might even sign him after this year because they can. You saw that with Aaron Ekblad.
Sure.
So I mean, the Oilers could sign Connor McDavid July 1st, and they will. Well, not just, I don't mean, yeah, July 1st. Yeah, you, yeah, mean either this summer summer, they'll sign him to an 8-year contract.
Look, everybody in the, I mean, I would be surprised if Connor McDavid played for another team besides the Edmonton Oilers in the course of his NHL career.
Well, yeah, why would they ever trade him? You're never going to get a player of equal value, right?
Right.
But back to Bruce Arthur's story here, Drew. I mean, when you're talking about whether or not the NHL is as exciting as the NBA, well, I mean, again, I think, you know, this has been one of the most exciting years in the NHL in a long time. Look at the Calder race. We were just talking about Matthew Tkachuk, Sean. I mean, in any other year, Matthew Tkachuk is a Calder Trophy finalist. You happen to have Patrick Laine, Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner, Zach Werenski, Matt Murray this year, right? So, and you're also having Sidney Crosby do things like he did yesterday, scoring a goal with one hand.
Yeah.
So as far as I'm concerned,
spearing a player in the nuts at the same time.
And if he's talking about more what's happening in the stands, I mean, we've all been to NHL games in various markets, whether that's Winnipeg, Montreal, you know, St. Paul. Yeah. We went to 3 games in the New York area, in New Jersey and Long Island, and then at MSG. So, I mean, I think that, you know, the in-game entertainment is excellent at NHL games. The NBA is different, right? I think, Sean, you're talking about apples and oranges here. The NBA and the NHL are not only different sports, but it's a different type of a fan experience.
It's also like, it's very hard to compare both when it comes to free agency, because in the NBA, it's very easy to focus on one superstar on your team. And a lot of times in the NBA, what that superstar wants, they kind of get. Sure. They want to go to a certain perennial contender. All they got to do is make it public, and somehow LeBron James ends up on the Heat, or
Shaq ends up being traded to the Lakers.
KD
or
goes to the
Celtics,
the Wizards. The Wizard. What am I talking about? The Warriors.
The Warriors. Kevin Durant.
Kevin
sorry.
Durant. Yeah, yeah, okay. Kevin Durant goes to the Warriors. It's different with hockey because hockey isn't revolve around one superstar and then a supporting cast. There's 4 lines.
Yep.
Everyone has their own value on the team. So with regards to free agency and stuff like that, it's very hard to compare. Where I do agree with Bruce Arthur, however, is when he talks about the online, the NHL.com's website compared to the NBA's website.
Yeah, the
where he talks about accessibility and information. I think the NHL is trying very hard to provide their fans with that type of easy access to information, and it's a work in progress. But with regards to experience of like online marketing, that kind of stuff, yeah, the NBA is far super.
I disagree, Sean. I'll tell you why.
I will
because
say this,
remember when Cap Geek folded.
Mm-hmm.
When Matthew passed away and Cap Geek folded, and somebody asked Gary Bettman if the NHL themselves would ever consider putting salary information on their website, and Gary Bettman made some sort of laughable statement about how he doesn't think fans actually care about that. When frankly, I mean, the website, you know, most fans probably go to as often, if not more often, than NHL.com is, you know, cap friendly because they need to know how salary caps factor in. I don't think the NHL goes out of their way to be fan friendly. I really don't. I think the NHL.
Yeah, maybe I portrayed my message wrong. I was saying that the NBA does a much greater job of providing the fans with that information.
Right.
And the NHL is slowly just kind of realizing, maybe even not.
I'm not even sure that they are realizing that. I mean, I think that the NHL is.
They revamped their website. What was that, 2 years ago?
Yeah, they revamped it. But
it's pretty much the exact same, just less user friendly.
Well, let me ask you, like, anytime you're looking for, you know, the quote unquote advanced stats. I don't know anybody who goes to NHL.com for it.
I don't think are they there?
They are. You have to search for them, and most people would say they're wildly inaccurate.
Yeah, but guys, hold on a second. We're talking about websites here. I mean, like, but a website is a website. I mean,
it's the official league website.
Right, but I think as far as the writing goes, I mean, over the years, you've had writers like Lisa Dillman, Tim Campbell, Tom Giulitti, Emily Benjamin join NHL.com. Mm-hmm. And I think Nick Kostanica is another guy. I mean, I think the writing on NHL.com is excellent.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
As far as how the stats are presented, Sean, I agree with you. Give me NHL.com 3 years ago. I don't need the advanced stats. I'll go on Natural Stat Trick or something like that for that.
That's what I'm saying, though. Isn't that the problem? That NHL.com, which is trying to provide that, I mean, they do have a section for it, and people still don't use it. And that's the league's website. That's the deep-pocketed organization. That's who should be. You should be able to pull up that information at your fingertips.
But again, Drew, when you're talking about the grand scheme of things, the experience, and really this is more so talking about the league as a whole and the fan experience, not really the web. I mean, the website, come on. I mean, I don't think.
No,
I don't think for the most part you can say the NBA is better because they have a better website.
People aren't following a sport because of their website. But I think the number one point that Bruce Arthur makes, and you look at baseball, you look at basketball, you look at football. They do everything in their power, and they have for everything for the last 5 to 10 years. The NFL was the pioneer in this to try and make the games as offensive, as high scoring as possible. The NFL, when they changed their pass interference rules to really make it very difficult for a defensive back to cover a wide receiver legally, it was all done to boost offense. Mm-hmm. Basketball, when they eliminated the hand check, has all been done to boost offense. The NHL, the efforts that they make to boost offense, I mean, most of these NHL games are offensively inept. A lot of these NHL games are offensively inept. You watched that game last night, guys. That was awful. Can you imagine
First of all, goal scoring's up, and when you're talking about the Jets, I mean, the Jets are top 10 in the league in goals. So I mean,
goal scoring's up to 2.77
sure.
goals per game.
Right, but we've had a lot of goals here at the MTS Center, right?
Sure.
Just recently with the Jets and the Wild and the Penguins. So, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that we haven't seen a lot of goal scoring.
No,
but
the
again,
Jets
Drew,
have.
My problem, and I have no problem with Bruce Arthur, my problem is, first of all, this article is very one-sided. I mean, it's clear that his kind of MO is to prove that the NBA is more fan-friendly.
Yeah,
I think you'd agree with that, right? So again, I mean, the whole kind of tone of the article is,
sure.
it's a little bit negative towards the NHL, I would say.
I would agree.
So when you're talking about, you know, the NHL and the fan experience, I mean, we go to the draft every year. The All-Star Game just took place in L.A. You know, everybody said it was a great event, and... Well, I mean, I think the NHL has a lot of great fans, and I think most hockey fans would disagree that the experience at most arenas around the NHL isn't fan-friendly.
I think that the NHL...
Could they be more fan-friendly, Drew? Sure.
Did you just call me Jew?
No.
Let's go to break. Joe Haggerty joins us from CSNNewEngland.com. Talk about the Bruins. He's up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290.
NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve returns on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour here on NHL This Week. The segment is brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to welcome back to the program Joe Haggerty. Joe covers the Boston Bruins for CSNNewEngland.com, CSNNE.com. Joe, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. How's it going?
Doing very well, Joe. Boston Bruins, currently third in the Atlantic Division, a point up on the Toronto Maple Leafs. The Leafs, two games in hand, currently tied with the Blue Jackets, 2-2 tonight. Lurking just behind the Leafs are the New York Islanders. They're 4 points behind the Bruins. They also have two games in hand. Are the Boston Bruins, is there any fear in that dressing room that they're in for yet another what I'm going to call April surprise or March surprise, where they collapse in the final weeks of the regular season and end up missing the playoffs?
Yeah, late season train wreck, whatever you want to call it. I don't think there's fear in the dressing room. You know, I don't think it's really entering into their minds, especially where it's only been a couple of games. But give it a few more losses, and I think that's going to creep in, and the questions are going to get more resonant and louder and stronger. And you know, it's mostly their own doing. They went 3-8-1 down the stretch last year, missed the playoffs by a point. They lost 9 of 14 games 2 years ago down the stretch at the end of the season, and missed the playoffs again by a point. So, you know, when it gets to this part of the year and you lose 3 games in a row and you lose a couple to Ottawa and Toronto, but the team's directly right in front of you and behind you in the Atlantic Division, you know, and you've got a white-knuckle grip on the playoff spot, of course, those questions get kicked up and you know, things start to tighten up a little bit. The good thing is, yes, they've lost those last two games, and it's put them in a little bit tougher spot, and, you know, a lot of their cushion is gone. But they still have two huge games this week against the Tampa Bay Lightning and the New York Islanders, who you referenced this weekend. And those become must-win games. And, you know, if they lose those two, yeah, I think there's going to be a runaway freight train of tough questions being asked of the Boston Bruins day in and day out about, you know, are they reliving history for the third straight year and doing a nosedive at the end of the season? But they've still got, you know, I think it's 5 of the 9 opponents that they face are non-playoff teams. 7 of the 9 games are at home. You know, it's a pretty decent schedule that they're playing. It's not overly difficult. So I don't think it's going to be a tremendously tough challenge for them to get in. But they just have to beat the rest of the teams that are below them. And the one thing is, you know, they may end up kissing the third place in the Atlantic Division goodbye. I could easily see the Leafs passing them over in that one and them losing out on that. I think it's going to be a much bigger shock if they blow both wild cards and if they fall below the Islanders and they're completely out of the playoffs altogether. You know, that's going to leave you potentially with a first-round matchup against the Washington Capitals, which I don't think the Bruins would last very long against them, but it would still get them into the playoffs anyway.
Joe, how would you assess the job that Bruce Cassidy's done since he took over for Claude Julien?
I think he's done a good job. I mean, obviously, we'll, you know, reassess after they pull out, if they do pull out of this three-game losing streak that they're in. And, you know, this is the real first big bump on the road for him since he took over. And, you know, he's been largely outstanding. He's had the team scoring more goals per game, allowing less goals per game. You know, they're 7-2 at home, where they've struggled at home on home ice the last couple of years. He has been playing a much more aggressive style most of the time, where the defensemen are really jumping into the play and becoming the fourth and fifth attackers on the rush. He's got the forwards keeping the puck down low and really attacking the net. And, you know, some of the younger players have responded to him as well in a positive fashion. You know, and for a while there, things were going really good. Now, in the last couple of games, against Ottawa and Toronto, more playoff-style games where things have tightened up. They've played a little less aggressively. There's been a little bit more of a conservative bent to their game. Brad Marchand and David Pastrnak have really carried the offense quite a bit of the time during all these games that they've won over the last 6 weeks. They've both have been held in check without goals in the last two games, and I think that's part of the reason the Bruins' offense has gone a tick down in those games. So, you know, we'll see what happens over the next few to get the grander scale of things. And it's going to be a much more difficult call on Bruce Cassidy if the Bruins, go south again this season. But, you know, from what I've seen so far, I think he's done a really good job. I like a lot of the changes that he's made, and he does some innovative things. He certainly has the team playing harder for him than Claude Julien did in the previous 55 games. And, you know, I think as long as they get in the playoffs, I think he's going to end up getting the job here on a permanent basis rather than the interim tag he has right now.
Joe, you mentioned David Pastrnak, and he's come out and said that he needs to be better following the weekend. And, you know, you talked about his lack of goal scoring over the last two games. Is this a guy that just puts a tremendous amount of pressure on himself?
I think he has big expectations for himself, but look, he's become a player. He's a 30-goal scorer this year. He's one of the main offensive cogs for the Bruins, even at 20 years old, and I think he understands that if the team is going to have success, then he has to produce, and he has to make things happen. And you know, I think he feels responsibility in that regard. And you know, he's a player that, like many players, I think being around guys like Patrice Bergeron and Brad Marchand, who are super competitors and who are high effort guys and hard workers, I think that's really rubbed off on him in a lot of different areas, including taking personal responsibility for things when they're going on. The one thing I would like to see on the ice is, you know, last couple of games, it seems to me this is the time of year when things get tighter. It's a more playoff style atmosphere and style on the ice. It's tougher to fight for your ice to get to the net and to, you know, just score goals. And there's been a little bit too much fanciness to his game. You know, he's been trying to toe drag guys, and you see him going between his legs when he's going behind the net on, you know, plays in heavy traffic that he shouldn't be doing. And, you know, this is not the time and place for the showcase kind of highlight reel moves. And I think a simpler game, a stronger game, and a grittier game would serve him well while matching with his fantastic skills. And I think that's really where he needs to get back to in order to have success. And I think that, you know, goes a little bit for Marchand, too. They combined for 8 giveaways in that game last night. Clearly, they're being too loose with the puck, and they need to be a little bit harder on it and make simpler plays, because right now they're, you know, feeding into the other team's defense, and they're not producing goals. And that needs to change if the Bruins are going to have success.
Joe Haggerty is our guest on NHL This Week. Joe covers the Boston Bruins for CSN New England. You can find his work at CSNNE.com. Joe, how's our old friend Drew Stafford looked since he came over at the trade deadline from good old Winnipeg here?
Yeah, you know, he was good at first. He had a first few good games right out of the chute. He played third line, second line, left wing, right wing there, kind of moving him all around and seeing how he fit. He responded pretty well in a lot of different situations, and he looked good. I think things have slowed down a little bit for him now. Some of that may be just, you know, the byproduct of a new team, new teammates. There aren't many guys besides David Backes, but I think he has a lot of personal history with on this team, and I think part of it was obviously his wife just giving birth to twins the other day, and that's a real life, understandably becomes something that you get preoccupied with a little bit. And, you know, certainly I think he was tired in that game in Toronto where his wife had just given birth, and then the next day he was there. That's a difficult turnaround for anybody. So a great moment in a couple of days for his life, but I'm sure it was exhausting. And I think that kind of reflected in the way he played on the ice. So, you know, he has shown some ability to get a shot off. Certainly plays physically at times and plays up to his size, and I think there are some things to like, but I think the Bruins would also probably like to see a little bit more consistency to his game, where he came out gangbusters in the first few and he slowed down a little bit now, and I think they'd like to see the same Drew Stafford every single night when they put him in the lineup.
Joe, when you think of Bruins defense, you still think of Zdeno Chara. Torrey Krug set a career high with 41 assists last night, and he's having another great year, and he's a guy that has taken a little bit while to develop, like some defensemen do. You think he gets enough recognition for how good of a defenseman he's turned into?
I don't think so, because I think a lot of people just view him as kind of a bottom-pairing guy and a power play specialist, or that's what he should be, you know, and that's kind of the view, because maybe it's because he's 5'8 and 170, 180 pounds. Maybe it's just because he's not a household name like some of the other guys who he basically has the same amount of points as this year from the defenseman position. But I can tell you he's made leaps and bounds in the last 2 years. He's never going to be a shutdown defenseman, obviously, but he holds his own and he survives in the defensive zone, and he's great moving the puck up the ice, making that first pass on the power play with the shot from the point and the vision and, the creativity. He can do a lot of really good things, and on top of all that, he's a tough, competitive kid, and he's got a little bit of that chip on his shoulder because he's one of the smaller guys out there on the ice. So, he led the team in ice time last night, 23-plus minutes. He's done that a lot this year. He's been a top-four guy the last 2 years, and there are times where it's difficult when he's out there against bigger, stronger players and better offensive players in the D zone. But, he makes it work enough of the time that you could see by the numbers that he gets a lot of production and he's a very good player. And, I'm sure the Bruins wish they could have a couple more guys like Torrey Krug that could move the puck up as adeptly as he does, because it would make their decor a lot more mobile and a lot more dangerous rather than what they have right now.
Joe, it was interesting. Last night after the Jets win in the postgame show, Michael Hutchinson, the Jets goaltender, credited watching Tuukka Rask during Bruins training camp as to how he tracks the puck with his glove hand, saying he's one of the best at it. He says he learned a lot watching him during that single training camp. Just focusing on Tuukka Rask right now is top play out of the goaltender from just critical now more than ever in his career as Boston enters this stretch.
Yeah, he needs to be their best player pretty much every night going forward these final nine games. And, he's been pretty good the last two. It was three redirections and deflections in front of him for each of the goals for the Ottawa Senators last night. One was a power play goal, and the third one was just a blown defensive coverage. The end-up game-winning goal was a blown coverage where they left Kyle Turris in the slot to redirect a Dion Phaneuf point shot. So, I don't think any of the goals were on him last night. He stopped 25 of 27 against Toronto, and neither of the goals were definitely against him in that game. And I thought he made some outstanding saves in both of those games. The one thing you look at from the Bruins side is they need to get more traffic to guys like Craig Anderson to make them work as hard as their goaltender is working right now. But it's an encouraging sign that he's played as well as he has in the last couple of games, because they're going to need that level and maybe even then some, I think, moving forward here to make sure that they punch their playoff ticket. And, basically from this point out, he needs to be their best player just about every single night, because they're not the most talented group. They're taking more risks offensively now, which allows more better chances for the other team and more odd man rushes. And they're relying on him to kind of be superhuman in a lot of these instances. And if he's not, they're not going to have success. So, yeah, he's a huge and key factor for the Bruins. And he's played well in big situations before, so they're going to need him to up that ante now, just like the rest of the team.
Joe, we had a segment on the show recently talking about whether or not Brad Marchand was a legitimate Hart Trophy candidate, and we all agreed that he is. You're in Boston. When you consider that he's got 37 goals and 80 points in 73 games, what's it like, I guess, on the street in Boston? Is there a big push from Bruins fans that, Brad Marchand really should be a serious contender for the Hart Trophy?
Yeah, I think there definitely is among Bruins fans. Given that Boston is obsessed with the Patriots 24/7 now, and rightfully so, and everything that goes on with them, I wouldn't say they're a chance in the streets about Marchand for Hart or anything like that. But I think there's a recognition that, he's gone from a fourth-line guy in his first year in the NHL, a pest and an agitator for his first few years and viewed basically as just that, to an elite player and a player that should be mentioned in the same breath as guys like Sidney Crosby and Connor McDavid for Hart Trophy consideration. And, he's got the numbers to back it up this year. And so many people thought that last year when he scored 37 goals, that was kind of a career year for him. And, he signed his big contract in the offseason, and he probably was never going to reach that level again, even though he'd been, very consistently a 25 to 30 goal guy every single full season in the NHL. So people expected a drop-off. Instead, not only is he up, matched the goal total from last year with a chance to get to 40 maybe, with nine games left, but he's added some playmaking and passing skills and more production in that category to his game. You know, and he's going to become the first point per game player, it looks like, for the Boston Bruins since Mark Savard almost 10 years ago. And that says quite a bit about him. I think it maybe also says something about Claude Julien's system and how they weren't going to be point per game players when he was the coach for the majority of that time. But I think it speaks so much to his development as a player, to him being on the power play now and being a huge weapon there, to him sort of figuring out how to best manage the puck, not turn it over, and create plays offensively for him and his teammates. And you put that along with, you know, the desire and the instinct to still agitate and still get under the other team's skin and pick the right spots to do it. And arguably, I think, the best penalty killer or the most dangerous penalty killer in the league. And you're talking about a player that does everything well. And, you know, if a guy that can put up numbers like he can and play in all situations like he can isn't the Hart Trophy candidate, I don't know who would be.
Joe Haggerty covers the Boston Bruins for CSN New England. You can read his work at CSNNE.com. And, of course, you can follow him on Twitter at Hacks with Hags. Joe, appreciate your time this evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. My pleasure. Take care.
When we come back, we'll do an out-of-town scoreboard update, and we'll look at the Eastern Conference playoff race, because it is getting quite entertaining in the Eastern Conference. You're listening to NHL This Week. One final segment to come here on TSN 1290.
NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets. TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Big thank you to Joe Haggerty for joining us. Earlier in the program, we heard from Hannah Spraker. Joe covers the Bruins. Hannah covers the Ducks. In case you missed either of those interviews, they'll be available on our website, illegalcurve.com, or you can just save yourself the trouble. Go on iTunes, subscribe to the show, get it sent to your iPod automatically, your iPod, your iPad, any other device I can't think of right now. Get it sent to you automatically each and every time we are on air.
Apple Watch.
Yeah, sure. Apple Watch could work. Maybe your iMac. I guess I forgot your iMac. That would also probably work in this instance.
Yeah.
Is there any other things? I'm not an Apple guy.
MacBooks?
Yeah. Well, isn't that what an iMac
is? That's iMac, yeah.
I don't know. I'm not an Apple guy.
iMac is a desktop computer.
Oh, an iMac is a desktop?
Yeah.
What's a lap? What's an Apple laptop
called? It's a MacBook.
A MacBook. Yeah. Ah, there you go. There you go. You learn something new every day.
There you go.
Yeah. In case you want to hear more of Ezzy and myself, we'll, of course, be on Saturday morning, 9 a.m. with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, and I'll be doing pre and post tomorrow evening with Mr. Rick Ralph. Ezzy will be doing pre and post with Mr. Rick Ralph on Friday evening.
Extended versions.
And is just planning on sleeping here as you'll get off air at about 1 a.m. on Saturday morning and have to be back for about 9 a.m. So you're going to be Mr. Chipper there on Saturday morning, aren't you there, big boy?
Yeah, well, hey, we got to do what we got to do, right? We're covering the Jets, and sometimes you have to stay up late to do that.
Yeah, these late games, yeah, you're absolutely right. We got to do what you got to do. Out-of-town scoreboard update, a typically quiet Wednesday evening in the NHL. Maple Leafs into Columbus. Huge game for the Leafs. Columbus just battling for the division lead in the Metropolitan Division.
They're battling for the President's Trophy
right
now.
I suppose they are battling for the President's
Trophy
as well.
That just sounds weird, though, to say that the Columbus Blue Jackets are battling for first overall in the league.
It doesn't sound right.
You're right. With a win tonight, they would, in fact, be first overall, or they'd be tied with the Capitals, and they would have the same number of regulation and overtime wins. So without going into the next tiebreaker, they would be tied with the Capitals for the lead in the President's Trophy.
That's what happens, Drew, when you win 16 games in a row.
It helps things. Currently down to the Leafs, though, 3-2. The Leafs lead the Blue Jackets after 40 minutes. A huge game for the Leafs if they were able to steal one in Columbus. They're also scoreboard watching as the Islanders and the Rangers are doing battle at Madison Square Garden after 20 minutes there. It is scoreless. It's a game that the Islanders desperately need as they're looking to, they're battling with the Leafs and the Bruins and, yeah, really the Leafs and the Bruins two of those three teams are going to make the playoffs, yet the Islanders certainly need a win, and doing so against their arch-rival Rangers would be helpful. Then later tonight, a game that'll matter to playoff positioning in the NHL's Pacific Division, the Oilers are into Anaheim to play the Ducks. Both those teams tied with 87 points. Both those teams tied with 35 regulation and overtime wins. So the winner of that game will be in second place. The loser will drop to third place in the Pacific Division.
Yeah, I still think San Jose is going to win the Pacific, Drew, but
yeah.
Edmonton and Anaheim are only 4 points behind San Jose. San Jose has cooled down a little bit, so again, Sharks probably
yeah, they have
will
the tiebreaker too.
Yeah, they have the tiebreaker, but you know, just saying, they're not that far away, maybe, as you would expect. So battling for second in the Pacific, as you said.
Yeah.
So there's only three games tonight, but a lot of playoff implications. If Toronto wins tonight and the Islanders aren't able to win, you fall behind 5 points, and that's going to be tough to make up. I mean, right now, Toronto is looking pretty good.
Yeah, they would be 5 points behind at that point in time. The Leafs would actually leapfrog the Bruins. The Bruins would fall into the second wild card spot, and the Islanders would be 3 points behind the Bruins, or pardon me, 4 points behind the Bruins with only one game in hand.
Don't count out the Lightning, though.
Oh, I don't know. That loss last night at home to Arizona, that might be the death knell for the Lightning.
That was the death
knell. I don't know if they can bounce back from losing that game to the Lightning when, you know.
I agree. I mean, they might be 6 points behind the Leafs if the Leafs win tonight, but I'm just saying, I wouldn't count them out. That's all I'm saying.
I'm
not saying
they're
going to make the playoffs. I'm just saying, 10 games left, a lot can happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be an interesting battle with the Lightning, but boy, that's a terrible loss last night.
Oh, they needed to win that game.
Yeah, that's about as bad of a loss as you're going to get there with the Lightning. It's going to be interesting. I think that's really going to come right down to the wire when it comes to the Eastern Conference playoff race between the Bruins, between the Leafs, and between the Islanders.
And Toronto doesn't have the hardest schedule. They've got New Jersey and Buffalo coming up, Drew. Yeah. But when you look at three of their last four games, I believe, are against Pittsburgh, Washington, and Columbus.
That's right. But those are they only have, not including tonight's game against Columbus. So after tonight's game against Columbus, of their remaining 10 games, only four of those 10 are against playoff teams.
And those are right at the end.
Right at the end, for the most part. You're absolutely right. So not a difficult schedule for the Leafs, but it'll be interesting. Of course, our playoff preview show coming up Monday, April 10th here on TSN 1290. That's it for this weekend NHL this week here on the program. Big thank you to our sponsors, Keener Jerseys, Zappia Group Realty, Bernstein's Deli, Linden Market Dental Center, and Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. Support those fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey and make these shows possible. Big props to producer Rory behind the board. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com. For Sean Asor and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Until Saturday at 9 a.m., we wish you good night and good luck.
As long as we stick together as a team, we'll be all right.